when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think, I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Putin.
I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi, and welcome to this Democracy Sausage episode, which falls in the electorally charged space between the federal budget and the calling of an election. I'm Mark Kenny, and I'm joined, as is customary, by my friend and colleague, Dr. Maria Tafaga, political scientist at ANU's School of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I am very well, thanks. Although I must say a little tired after what's been a pretty frenetic sort of period in my kind of hybrid life on both sides of the lake.
Budget time is actually a stressful time for a lot of people in Canberra. That's true.
Yeah, possibly not so many voters as might be the case after some budgets, but that may have something to do with the proximity of an election. Also with us is another outstanding political scientist, Dr. Jill Shepherd, from the same School of Politics and International Relations at ANU. Welcome back, Jill.
G'day, Mark.
Good to have you along, as always. Probably the first time in 2022, but hopefully not the last. And from RMIT, it's welcome to Dr. Leonora Riss, who is an economist and who, among other things, many other things, in fact, is co-founder of the Women in Economics Network and who spoke so persuasively at a Women in Economics event at the National Press Club last year with a couple of other eminent economists, and it was a really terrific event. Welcome to you, Leonora.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Maria. Thanks for having me.
Now, Scott Morrison told a Perth interviewer just a few hours, really, before we record this chat, that he doesn't plan to go to the Governor-General this weekend because there is governing to do. Perhaps he should have thought of that 3 years ago. No, that was unkind. It is one of those things we can't necessarily take literally. He could just, you know, you might want to just say, well, he could say that. He would say that anyway. He's not going to flag when he's going to do it, probably. But on the other hand, we know it's going to be very, very soon. So that's really the frame in which we look at this budget. But it's a difficult situation for him. He's not actually, amazingly, you're meant to be when you're the incumbent, you're meant to be in charge of all of these things. You're in charge of the timing. You're in charge of the arrangements on your side of the fence. Yet in his home state of New South Wales, his own party is in disarray with court battles, executive control of pre-selections, and candidates not yet on the ground in several key seats needed to win the election. In other words, seats he needs to form a majority to retain the majority he currently has, they don't have candidates in right on the edge of an election. And if they're marginal seats, you would have wanted to have those candidates there a year ago, probably, Maria.
Yeah. I mean, there has been a lot of speculation that he would go to the GG this weekend, but yeah, he doesn't actually have all of his candidates in place. And as you say, some of these are subject to a legal challenge. So, no, I don't think he is going this weekend. That would be my guess, though I guess he could resolve it by the end of the week, I suppose.
Well, he could, but I mean, it just makes you wonder what is going on, what sort of planning's been going on. This has been drawn right out to the very end of when the election needs to be held. It needs to be held by the 21st of May, which means that he's only really got a couple of weeks to play with now. Prime ministers often go before the end of the 3 years, but he's taking it right up to the end. And even with all that time, there's still problems inside the New South Wales division. And we saw those problems kind of explode, really. On the same night as he was delivering the budget, we had Senator Concetta Fierro of Anti-Wells unloading on the PM, giving us a very frank assessment of the man.
This was an extraordinary speech for the adjournment debate, which is, traditionally can be quite a fiery debate. But in essence, Concetta Fierro-Vanti-Wells, who does actually have a track record of calling out her own government. It's not the first time she's called out her own party and her own government.
They call it outspoken, don't they?
Yes, I guess so, outspoken. and she's setting a good example, actually, because squeaky wheels get the grease, as it were. But she essentially outlined on the record and under parliamentary privilege what actually happened to her pre-selection for a Senate spot. And so in that, she basically said a few things. She pretty much accused the minister, Alex Hawke, of, arranging a deal with Dominic Perrottet to basically shaft her out of a winnable spot on the Senate seat.
Now, we should say, just for clarity, Alex Hawke is the immigration minister. He's also very close to Scott Morrison, and he's effectively Scott Morrison's representative on the executive in New South Wales. So he's the prime minister's kind of man proxy, as it were, and he's described often as the PM's consigliere.
That's right. He's also an important factional power broker in his own right of the centre-right faction. So there are three factions in the Liberal Party, the moderates, that would be Trent Zimmerman and co., the centre-right, which is Alex Hawke, and the far-right, or just the right, which is Dominic Perrottet, Concetta Fierro-Vanti-Wells. And in this speech, which Concetta basically outlaid how she helped Scott Morrison get into Parliament in the first place, which she then deeply regretted, she explained how ultimately forces, basically sanctioned or endorsed by Scott Morrison, made a deal with, via Alex Hawke and Dominic Perrottet, her so-called ally, to basically shaft her out of a winnable spot on the Senate election, which she said was necessary because ultimately she had the votes, and that she sort of also outlaid some sort of extraordinary kind of, I guess, accusations around corruption, and also kind of drew, I guess, the public's attention to the fact that Scott Morrison, for example, hasn't faced a pre-selection contest for a decade, which is a profound denial, I guess, of party members' rights. And the final thing she said, which was perhaps the most devastating and the most shocking, was that she sort of, and launched a profound character attack on the Prime Minister, saying that his religious piety was fake, that he lacked a moral compass, that he was the most ruthless person she had met in a ruthless party, and that he was not fit to be Prime Minister. It was.
And he's a bully.
Yeah, it was. Well, I think Pauline Hanson said that. But yes, like,
I think
it
she
was
says it well, as well.
Absolutely a devastating broadside.
It was, and it was what does, I think, more damage in respect of this is the cumulative value of this, because this is not the first character assessment that we've heard of from people working closely with Scott Morrison. You know, we've had the Barnaby Joyce texts talking about his Morrison's untrustworthiness. There's the text between Gladys Berejiklian and a minister. There's been, of course, the things that people like Julia Banks have had to say. Anyone who's working in the press gallery has spoken to others who are less inclined to put their names to things, but who tell you that Scott Morrison's pretty deeply unpopular within his own party room. So these sort of testimonials and harsh comments, Julia Banks describing him as a menacing wallpaper in the way he approaches things. That's in a sense where a lot of the damage is being done, I think, with this is the sort of each time someone comes out with this, it lends a bit more credibility to to the general chorus.
Yeah, it certainly builds up a picture. And I mean, look, you know, Concetta Ferravanti-Wells has been around Liberal Party politics since the early 90s. So she would have fully understood just how destabilizing her adjournment speech on like 1 hour into selling the budget would have been. And it sort of, I guess, goes to the level of fury that she personally has and that others within the New South Wales branch have around what is perceived to be an orchestrated campaign of administrative and bureaucratic obstruction that has actually seen rather unprecedented events. Like there is effectively a federal intervention of the New South Wales Liberal Party at this time, which honestly, I never thought I would have seen. I never would have thought that a party as
defiantly federalist.
Yes, and resistant to to central intervention would have actually ever endorsed, a process in which the centre would be able, like that is, you know, like people outside of the state to impose candidates. And you know, some of these decisions are now subject to legal challenge and none of it is actually resolved, right? So it is absolutely kind of chaos. And that was another kind of argument that she made, actually, that he had actually destroyed the party's constitution.
Yeah, and that rank and file members are so dejected and demoralized and angry about all of this that vast numbers of them are withdrawing their services. They're not confident of winning the election. They're not confident of winning various seat contests. Many of them are pulling out and in disgust or demoralized. Jill, is it a surprise that a Prime Minister who actually probably made his name in the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party by being its director and therefore, you know, being the coming through the organisational side of the party, that he's ended up with this kind of localised mess in his home state when he's right on the cusp of a, you know, really do-or-die election?
I think what's interesting here, and it's not that Ferravanti-Wells is angry with Scott Morrison, because as Maria mentioned, she's got a pretty galling track record on any number of issues, and the number of progressives who I've seen, you know, come out in defence of her and praising her this week has been, you know, at best surprising and at worst pretty shocking and disappointing, I think. The really interesting thing, I think, in all this is that Scott Morrison has governed quite smoothly on the basis of having support from most sides of his party room. Now, support is easy to hold together inside a party room when things are good, right? You've got money to spend, polling is great, you know, you're keeping everyone together, you're all focused on one particular goal. When things start to fall apart, you know, we had COVID, we've had bushfires, we've had floods, we've had pretty horrendous budget contraction, and now we've got bad polling, you know, for the government. It's a mountain of things that you're expected to face together. And when times get tough, you know, people turn on each other. The stuff in New South Wales, like the boring inside baseball stuff around who controls which branches, you know, these pre-selections that are going to judicial challenges, that's the really juicy thing here. Scott Morrison hasn't been able to hold his home state's party together. And it's going to blow up. I think he will go to the Governor General this weekend because I think he needs to be able to say to the federal executive of the Liberal Party, time to draw a line under this. We're going in. We're going to appoint people and let's move on. I don't think he can allow this to drag on much, much sooner. And I think to the extent that it does create credibility problems for Scott Morrison, it is that he doesn't have this, he's losing this status as someone who can keep the party together.
Because that's his thing, isn't it? Competence. It's meant to be his kind of actual advantage.
So, well, I guess what is
inoffensive centrism, right? He was the guy that rose above the factional intrigue in New South Wales. He had friends in every camp.
That's right. He's the guy that actually ended the Turnbull-Abbott wars, really, by coming up through the middle.
Right, and I think his problem is he's loved everyone. You know, he's beloved by all, but no one actually protects you. You know, he's got no Praetorian Guard. And Maria and I have talked about this. This was Howard's strength, right? Come at Howard. He had people lined up who would throw themselves on the sword for him, and Morrison doesn't have that.
Well, that's the thing about parties, right? Like, believing in something is actually really important when you're a member of a political party, and that is why he lacks a Praetorian kind of guard beyond the sort of Pentecostal religious circle that makes up the center right faction. And one of the things that is driving this conflict is the perception that this is a conflict that is being engineered by the center right faction, which Scott Morrison is part of, in order to essentially, the argument goes, to sort of secure long-term position of the centre-right faction, which is seen to be under threat from the growing power of the right and the sort of strongholds that the moderates kind of control certain parts of Sydney, and they're never going to let that kind of go because of demographics. And so this is sort of seen as a plot internally within the Liberal Party for the centre-right to maintain its strength where it's potentially losing strength. So in the seat of Alex Hawke, there is a contention from the far right that they actually could win that seat, and that's why he doesn't want to face a pre-selection, and that by basically forcing some kind of federal committee that the centre-right can dominate that because they are part of the Prime Minister's faction, and in a sense kind of sort of shape the rules around how the New South Wales Liberal Party will go forward and entrench their ability to kind of retain some control over the outcome. That is sort of the sort of additional kind of context that is sort of driving this context. And so, if this is actually true, right, because this is all contested, then it is an extraordinary thing for the Prime Minister to have potentially actually engineered a situation where it looks like he has lost control of his party.
I mean, lost in all this is that one of Fiera Fanti Wells' complaints against Morrison is that he's not Christian enough.
Yeah, and not right-wing, not right-wing enough.
Right. So if you're trying to kind of paint this as, as a groundswell of support from your average Liberal battler, I mean, it's on shaky ground.
Well, it is. The other thing that's really interesting about it, I'd be interested in all your views about this, is that it sort of comes really just in the same period of time, only a couple of weeks after the untimely and tragic death of Kimberly Kitching. And Kitching was, I mean, there are some similarities in Kitching and Concetta Fierravanti-Wells, and that is, they're both sort of associated very much with sort of the conviction side of politics within their parties. Both kind of outspoken, both peddlers in intrigue in some ways, really involved in factional stuff. Kitching in the Labor right in Victoria, and obviously Fierravanti-Wells here in New South Wales, and they're also both quite warm individuals personally, with a certain charisma. Now, unfortunately, Kitching's gone, but the PM wasn't shy of talking about Kitching, as he was trying to use that to put a bit of pressure on Anthony Albanese. It's just interesting to see he's now faced with the same circumstance. He's got a very senior woman who has been bumped into an unwinnable spot and who is lashing out ferociously and telling some home truths. They can dismiss it as sour grapes, and there's no doubt an element of that in this, but there is a good deal of umbrage. This speaks to a deep battle with inside the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party, and deep umbrage and a loss of any real, I think this goes to your point, Maria, about the Praetorian Guard or lack of around Morrison, a lack of real authority or affection for this Prime Minister within his own party.
Well, I guess if we sort of step back a little bit, I think it is kind of interesting that this is the most, political point that has kind of come out of the budget in a way, that it's once again, there's a deep irony, I suppose, is another way of putting it, that character actually has once again become central to this political contest. And this is a long-running debate within the Liberal Party. Like, this is actually a battle that traces its origins back to the mid-1970s. And I will not relate how that is the case, but it kind of goes to a couple of important sort of factors that Jill highlighted, right, which is that, yes, this is definitely a debate about internal party democracy, but that is because it suits one side of the factional debate to push forward internal party democracy because they have the numbers, right? So Ferravanti-Wells exactly. faction has more members because of the pattern of recruitment that has that has gone on within the Liberal Party. So the membership base of the Liberal Party is far more, you know, I guess, right-wing and Christian conservative than the average Liberal Party median voter. And that, you know, this whole kind of conflict is kind of really putting this up in lights that, you know, where the Liberal Party is at as an organization and where they are as a sort of, you know, aggregator of voters' interests are increasingly moving further and further kind of apart. And it sort of explains why there are real challenges in the way Morrison has to kind of build a voting coalition. He's got to sort of satisfy these seats where these teal independents are pressuring the Liberal Party because, you know, their moderate MPs keep losing fights to the right and the centre-right who have been able to dominate far more of the policy agenda over the life of this government. Not necessarily the last 2 years, but the life of this government.
That's an excellent piece of analysis. Very well put, I think. Jill, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty big elephant in the room here, and I'm willing to be spicy if no one else is. And
that's get into it.
Gender angle, right?
Yes.
We're looking for connections between Ferravanti-Wells and Kitching, and they're both women. They're both women who probably wouldn't have described themselves as feminists 10 or 15 years ago when they were getting into Parliament, Ferravanti-Wells before Kitching. But, you know, Kimberley Kitching had a long history around Victorian politics in particular and the sort of centre-right of the Labor Party. These are women who were at the very forefront of conservative, small-c conservative women breaching the sort of threshold, the glass ceiling in their parties. And they now exist, I'm speaking slowly to choose my words very carefully, they now exist in a very highly charged era for discussions around gender and gender politics and sexism and discrimination. And so I think they have, their experiences over two decades are fascinating, right? They came in when they had to be a very Thatcheresque, you know, act like a man because you have to out-masculine the men. And now they exist in an era where femininity and the differences between men and women in politics are not just important but are, you know, agonized over. And so I think Ferravanti-Wells in particular has leaned very hard on all of the challenges that women in politics face now that she is in decline. And she is, in many ways, probably a woman out of era, right? And I'm really interested to hear what Leonora has to think about this because she is a woman in a very sort of masculinized industry as well. And the way that we do have to turn on our femininity sometimes and then turn it off at other times is hard and fraught, and it's hard to talk about, let alone to actually do.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And there is quite a history of women in the kind of era of politics you're talking about there, Jill, whose feminism becomes slightly more pronounced, if I can be polite about it, when they've left or when they've just lost a battle. There are others, of course, many others now in the younger generation who are strongly identified with it. I'm not trying to diminish it. It's just that sometimes we don't see some of these really strident comments coming out from some of those who've been around a bit longer until such time as things have turned south for them. Look, let's take a quick break there, and when we get come back, we'll talk about this budget because initially, I suppose that's what we thought we'd be talking about, but as a fear of Ferravanti-Wells probably intended, a lot of the budget discussion has been derailed by the fireworks in the Senate. So back in a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync,
things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to monday.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we had originally thought we'd be talking just about the budget, but of course, as I say, the fireworks in the Senate with Concetta Fierro of Anti-Wells certainly derailed that to a large extent, and there will be ongoing discussion of the issues around that. And a few people have joined in on her behalf since. Pauline Hanson and Jackie Lambie have both sort of jumped up in the Senate and said, yeah, yeah, I think he's a bully too, which is not going to, you know, be helpful for the Prime Minister as he weighs up his decision as to when to go see the Governor-General. As Jill says, it could happen this weekend. It might not. Certainly, senators have been told that they are – this is coalition senators have been told that they are expected to be back in Canberra next week for Estimates Committee meetings. So at this stage, that's the – you know, they're the signals they're sending out. And the PM, as I said, has told an interviewer that he wasn't planning to go to the Governor-General's this weekend. But, I think Jill could well be right. Anyway, look, let's get back to the budget. And as I introduced at the start, we have Dr. Leonora Riss from RMIT. She's an economist, and she's perhaps more qualified than the rest of us to talk about the budget. So, Leonora, I thought I might start with asking you just what your overall impression of the budget was.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. And, you know, even as an economist, listening into your discussion about the political fireworks is still fascinating for me as well. You know, the budget, I'm thinking about your discussion there about the government overall, and the budget is an opportunity for governments to really assert what do they want their legacy to be, you know, and what will their legacy be. And even before we open up the first page of the budget, we have to consider what is the economic climate at the moment, because that sets us up to be able to evaluate, is this responsible, sensible, constructive policy, as opposed to what is a political election-oriented policy. So even before opening up the first page of the budget, we have to keep in mind we're looking at an economy where unemployment is strong, job opportunities are strong. That's in the wake of the government injecting a hefty amount of stimulus into the economy during the first year of the pandemic.
$314 billion, the government says, that it has injected into wage subsidies during the pandemic. That's an astronomical amount of money.
That's right. But, you know, at least we're seeing signs that it did pay off, in terms of there are absolutely some people out there, many people who are still struggling to get the hours they need and to get a good quality job. We know it's definitely hasn't solved all the problems, but looking big picture, unemployment, we're now looking at potentially a rate of unemployment dropping below 4%. And I mention that because, coming back to this story of what will the government's legacy potentially be, I think they've swung this into an opportunity for them to, instead of being remembered as the government that brought this the budget back into black and back into surplus, they obviously had to abandon that goal.
They had the cuts made there.
They now, it seems, want to be remembered for being the government that brought unemployment below 4%. So it's like they've changed their goal, and they're going to hope. I imagine that's the narrative that they are aiming to associate with this government in the history.
Can I just stop you there, Leonora, and ask you this question? Does that mean, if that's right, that a liberal conservative government is now sort of retooling, repositioning to make as its major claim the policy outcome of what is essentially hyper-Keynesianism in budget management, in economic management?
Yeah, well, they've demonstrated that when the government steps in and compensates for a collapse in confidence in the private sector and the public sector steps in there by way of government stimulus, it can reignite the economy. And that's what Keynesian would prescribe, Keynesianism would prescribe. It's very much at odds with the traditional conservative story about being fiscally responsible, fiscally disciplined. And so we are seeing an about turn in this narrative, which I think is fascinating because it goes to show how really budgets are a toolkit. They're not a goal in and of itself.
And this one especially, really, because this one's main job was to get them to the other side of the election, really, wasn't it? To be a credible, for that it needed to be a credible economic blueprint. It couldn't just be simply a whole series of voter bribes that would lead to inflation and completely lead to mayhem. But at the same time, it is largely the heavy lifting this budget was required to do is more political than the heavy lifting a budget, say, in the first year of a term might ordinarily be required.
That's correct. We're at a different point of the business cycle now. We've moved from that recession period into this strong growth and upswing, and actually, this is why differentiating the political from the economics is really vital, because the economic rationale would prescribe that this is not the time to keep spending. Those inflationary pressures, especially coming from the supply side of the economy, those production costs, those supply bottlenecks, barriers to labour force participation, that spells out a case for a government to be restrained from these broad-based, splashing cash and instead look at the supply side of the economy. This should have been a supply-side budget, and it wasn't. It was very much geared for political favour.
Jill, do you think that's actually as true as all that is, it just has to obviously obey the political realities of where they are. They're just about to face an election. But they do come up with a budget which is, even if we think about it politically, has sort of two almost contradictory narratives. One is, we've done very well with the economy. We're excellent economic managers, and Australia is better than the rest of the world and going gangbusters. Look at the unemployment rate, for example, and a range of other things. And the other narrative is, these are uncertain times. The war in Ukraine, a whole lot of vulnerabilities and variabilities in the environment. Not a time to change government. In fact, it's so uncertain and the cost of living is so difficult that we're going to give you some emergency funding. And so we've got cash handouts to welfare recipients. We've got an increase in the low and middle income tax offset. We've got the halving of federal, petrol excise. These are all things that are essentially emergency measures. Is the emergency economic or political?
Well, it's political. As Leonora says, unemployment is going to have a four in front of it again soon. We've written this out, right? I don't know how. I'm not an economist, but we got through this somehow totally fine. I think the genius of this budget, the more that I dwell, the more that I reflect on this, is that it's a complete Rorschach test. If you think that the government has spent too much money and is being economically reckless, you can convince yourself of that from this budget. If you think that the government should be spending more, you can convince yourself of that in this budget too. I think it, so to that extent, it's just a mirror of our, previous partisanship. However we feel about this government is going to reflect very strongly how we feel about this budget. And it's for the economists to actually try to, parse out what is good economic policy and what isn't. I think the fuel excise, yes, it's an emergency sort of response to a massive political problem, but it does put Labor in a really tough position. How does Labor go out? We're recording this on Thursday. How does it not match that tonight without looking like you are punching down on people who are doing it very hard in terms of petrol prices? But at the same time, that leaves Labor with the same kinds of criticism, of overexpenditure that the Liberals face. So maybe I'm just getting cynical in my old age, but, the more I think about it, the more I think this is a pretty trying not to swear, a pretty impressive budget.
So I
politically,
think
that, politically, I should say.
I think that's really interesting, Jill, and kind of on the point there. Like, there's a couple of things going on here. Like, one is it is sort of interesting that the government hasn't been able to kind of claim as much credit for managing the pandemic as well as it has. And it's sort of an interesting kind of you reap what you sow kind of thing with Labor and the GFC, that even though we get lauded around the world for having done a really good job of managing large systemic exogenous shocks at home, no one's happy. So that was the first thing I find really interesting. The second thing, what Jill said about the risks for Labor, I think are actually kind of spot on. And I think they actually understand this, but I don't think they have an alternative, and I don't think they think they have an alternative. And that is essentially, you know, they're hoping to win this election campaign by emphasizing the cost of living and wages growth and, you know, people doing it tough. And the government has done some odd sort of things in the way it wants to spend money, and, you know, 6 months of, you know, petrol excise and a one-time boost to this sort of supposedly one-time tax offset for middle-income earners. You know, these are effectively kind of like booby traps. And it does kind of raise the question, should Labor actually win this poll and have to actually govern? Well, what are they actually able to really do about wages growth, which is ultimately linked to a one-time boost in productivity during the mining boom, right? Sorry, a one-time boost in wages, which was not linked to productivity, and this is like a long-term correction. You know, what are they actually going to do to increase wages? Are they actually like advocating, you know, a wages breakout? Like, you know, we're facing the risk of inflation.
I don't think we're really in wages breakout territory.
No, we're not. But like, you know, Labor is arguing that your wages haven't increased for 10 years. The reason for that is because we had a huge spike in wages because of the mining boom. It wasn't matched by a productivity growth. And so we've seen a correction over the last 10 years. And no one in politics has actually wanted to sort of say that.
Yeah, but that's because it's not the whole story. There are people, we have had also a dramatic, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Leonora, we've had a dramatic increase in precariousness in the workforce. We've got more people in part-time and casual work. That's why we saw so many people lose their jobs and get propped up ideally by assistance through the pandemic. Some of them weren't, of course, because they had very little rights, you know, casual workers and the like. And then we saw so many people come back on so quickly because that is the feature of a temporary and casualized workforce. And that's why so many of them were women. And the government saying, oh, what a great job we're doing with women's employment. Look at all the new jobs that have come back in that are owned by women. Yeah, they're owned by women, those jobs, temporarily owned by them in that sense. But the labor market power of those people has been dramatically reduced over recent, you know, because of the changes in this political economy. We just don't have the mechanisms at the moment or the leverage for getting people on the bottom rung better wages. So there are things governments can do. This government, for example, could be supporting the aged care wage case that's being considered at the moment. That would go a long way to addressing the fact that nurses, carers in aged care are getting 25 to 48% less than people, the comparable work in other parts of the healthcare sector. You know, and these are mostly women. There are lots of things they could do. They're the largest employer in the country by themselves, the federal government. They could actually, you know, unfreeze public sector wages. That would potentially have an effect. Leonora, any comments on any of what I've just said?
No, Mark, I think you have already identified, I think, the various levers that are at the disposal of governments that feed into wage growth. So I think the story that the current Morrison government has tried to feed the general public is one of, well, wage growth is just an organic outcome of an economy. When it's strong, it's growing, you know, it trickles down, that somehow that a strong, vibrant work economy will transpire, well, that wage growth will transpire from that. But they have over time dismantled and weakened some of the institutional settings that facilitate that. So I was also thinking along the lines of what's really important is for the government to assert its position on these fair pay cases, such as the ones that are being heard at the moment in relation to aged care workers. There are cases that are put before the commission on childcare. That is an opportunity for a government to play a role in setting those wages. There's also an opportunity to prop up female concentrated sectors as opposed to male concentrated sectors when you're deciding on which parts of the economy to channel your fiscal stimulus towards. So when we've seen large amounts of government spending go towards infrastructure and construction and trades, that's great if you work in those fields. And this is where the gender lens is so important because the same sort of support wasn't directed towards childcare and aged care. And part of that support is about the workforce. So supporting that pipeline of workers and the current workers by way of wages, where again, the government can play a role there, and also setting standards for working conditions so that we see the retention of those workforces as well. Another, we mentioned gig work also and casual work. There's also a role there in directly for governments to set the architecture around regulation and protecting the rights of those workers. And that means that you're tilting the bargaining power a little more towards employees, given that that has been tilted the other way for many decades over time, so that workers' needs and rights are factored into these employment contracts. So government does have a role in that way. And I would say that over time, I think what we've seen is the Labor government in general, putting aside their values statement and their ideology, they just have more experience in doing these things. And even I think back to when JobKeeper was rolled out, yes, it saved a lot of jobs. It kept a lot of employees attached to their employer, which was important. But at the same time, because it was so broad-based and so hurried, and perhaps there was a lack of consultation along the way, we now find out that so much of that support was given to companies and businesses that really didn't need it. So because that came from a government that, you know, that wasn't their forte, handing out assistance or designing support mechanisms, they haven't got a great track record. And so when the time came to do it, the economic conditions necessitated something was needed. They just didn't have that track record or that in-house expertise to be able to tailor it in the most efficient and equitable way.
Yeah, that's true. And it's interesting, even in aged care, the government, you know, defends itself saying that it plugged $17.5 billion into increased funding into aged care in recent years. The trouble is most of that money, because of the way they've done it, has ended up going to providers, not to aged care workers. And even in this budget, Leonora, just quickly, because we're getting a bit close to time now, but even in this budget, when you think about aged care as a federal responsibility and you think about childcare, something the Labor opposition is about to campaign on quite strongly, it has much stronger childcare reform policy in the marketplace already. Were you surprised that this budget was largely silent in both of those areas?
Yes. Look, maybe our expectations were too high, but you know, what's needed is not just, even if they were to announce something, you can't just announce more places without thinking about the supply side again. So where are the workers? Where is the resourcing? And is it being channeled towards workers? As you mentioned, a lot of that funding is going to the hands of the providers, the operators, not necessarily feeding through to the workers themselves. So what there should have been in the budget was some acknowledgement that if the aged care pay case goes ahead and is successful, where is the money that's earmarked in the budget to support that?
Yeah, good point.
So I guess it indicates that they're not expecting it to be successful or that it just isn't on their radar.
Can I ask you, all three of you, and just get a quick answer from all three of you? It's a bit of a game, a sort of a gear change here. But I'm here with three very educated, intelligent women, been thinking about a lot of these issues in your different dimensions. What do you think to the proposition that that women as a dynamic in this election could be important?
Well, I mean, I do think we already know that women are more likely to vote for left-wing parties, and this is a change that has happened from moving from voting predominantly for right-wing parties to moving for voting for left-wing parties. And I do think, as I've sort of said before, that the pandemic has perhaps highlighted to perhaps a new cohort of women just how government could potentially make their lives easier through the provision of free childcare being the most obvious example. And then, you know, seeing what that is like and then seeing that being taken away. And that might perhaps make this issue salient for a whole bunch of people who might not have really cared about it.
Jill?
Look, I think, I mean, obviously Maria's right. Women since Julie Gillard's prime ministership have been moving more comprehensively towards the Labor Party in Australia. But traditionally, they were conservative voters. And I say they as though women are all, you know, one homogenous block, which absolutely they're not. But women were disproportionately likely to vote for the coalition in Australia. I saw a recent news poll that had aggregated a bunch of recent surveys they'd run, and they found that women had better assessments, basically more favourable assessments of Scott Morrison than men did, and they preferred Morrison to Albanese on a few, like, you know, sort of key important measures, which I thought was sort of interesting. I don't think that the hot elbow memes are really trickling through to the mainstream voters, which, you know, we shouldn't be surprised about. But yet we consistently are surprised that Twitter and Facebook aren't real life. I don't think there's anything to suggest really that, and again, you know, choosing words carefully, that the median woman in Australia cares too much about sexual harassment in Parliament. I don't think these issues that we've all been focused on so much for the last 2 years will actually change votes on election day. I think per normal, we will go back to the economy, healthcare, education. In some elections, immigration, probably not this one so much. Maybe there'll be voters among us who are thinking deeply about national security, but that's how we vote. And I don't think the women's issue, you know, that looms so large for a lot of us in our professional lives will make much difference on election day.
Yeah. Leonora, just to you finally, I mean, because I guess what was behind my question was I was thinking about, you know, Wayne Goss's famous observation, I think it was back in 96 when he said voters were, you know, quietly resolved to change the government. They were, as he described it, waiting on the veranda with baseball bats for Labor. Slightly violent image, but you know, the point being that there can be this sort of subterranean shift as a result of the atmospherics of the images of politics really over recent times, whether people have looked at Scott Morrison and thought, I know a man like that, I know a man who you know, behaves like that. What's your sense?
Yeah, again, I would echo some of the other panelists' comments that we can't speak on behalf of all women. There's a lot of diversity amongst females, the female population, including a lot of disadvantaged and marginalised women who really don't have a voice at all. But I think overall, when we look at women's engagement in social, political, environmental, economic issues, we shouldn't underestimate women's political literacy, their economic literacy, particularly this younger cohort coming through. I mean, I teach my economic students in first year at university, and you see they are engaged through social media, through technology, through greater channels of information. They're being fed more information to be attuned to these issues. And I actually do think that respect and integrity, it does matter. I think that transcends politics and economics. And when women feel that they are part of a collective group within society where they can share their experiences with other women, and they can, and they know that they're not alone, but, you know, that they're part of a broader group. I think we're seeing that mobilization of women outside of the formal political sphere, perhaps, but there is a lot of action and advocacy happening at the moment amongst women's groups and with male allies and supporters as well. So I think there are a lot of women looking at the political landscape at the moment, and for them, respect and integrity does matter.
Hmm. Interesting. We'll see what happens there. That's all we've got time for today. If we've been a bit longer than normal, but I think if you're listening, you've stayed with us all this time, you'll agree with me. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and you know, with a federal election looming, perhaps that's our excuse for going a little bit longer and dwelling on some of these issues. And we're going to have a lot to talk about over the next 6 or 8 weeks, depending on when the starter's gun is fired and the date named, either probably the 14th or the 21st of May for that election. Leonora Riss, Jill Shepherd and Maria Tafaga, thanks very much for coming on Democracy Sausage again.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks, guys.
Great. Thanks.
And that's it for now. We'll talk to you again soon. And look out for what we've got planned, a couple of interesting events, Democracy Sausage-wise, for the election itself. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.